So the following message is the 12th and final talk on the book of Hebrews.
We're at the end of Hebrews 11. I want to pick up where we left off with verse 39, Hebrews 11, 39. Having talked about this great series of heroes from the Old Testament, he summarizes, "And all these, though well attested by their faith, did not receive what was promised, since God had foreseen something better for us, that apart from us, they should not be made perfect." And he goes on, "Therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us also lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely, and let us run with perseverance the race that is set before us, looking to Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God." All these great heroes, the great giants and the lesser heroes from the Old Testament, died in faith. They were men and women of faith. That's why their stories are recounted. And yet they died in faith, still looking ahead to the ultimate fulfillment of God's promises. He fulfilled promises along the way. Hebrews 11 tells us lots of stories of mighty things that God did, but not ultimate fulfillment of his promises. The ultimate promises were that one day they would inherit a better country. One day there would be a new city. One day they would have heaven itself given them, and that was not fulfilled, and it still hasn't been. That promise still is before us, and so with them, we are now called to run the race that is set before us. I want you to be clear that the great cloud of witnesses, or your translation may say the great crowd of witnesses, are not sitting in the stands witnessing us. We have that mental picture, I think. Here we are in the citrus bowl with all these saints who have gone before us, and they're sitting there in the stands watching us as we run our lap around the track. That's not what he's saying. They are witnessing to us. They are witnessing by their faith, by their experience of God. I made it. We made it. The going was tough, but the tough got going. Keep on keeping on. They are witnessing to us about God's faithfulness. They are witnesses for us, not primarily witnesses of us. And the principal witness out of that great cloud of witnesses, the principal witness is Jesus himself. He made it. And he made it all the way to the throne room of God. He already is experiencing the heavenlies which still are before the rest of us. We're asked to consider what it cost him. His very life. Cost him the cross, cost him the shame of rejection and crucifixion. It cost him the pain, the brutal pain physically, and worse than that, the spiritual pain, the horror, which I don't think you and I can even imagine, of having been from before the foundation of the world in the closest of fellowship with the Father, to then be separated from him for you and me. To enter into the hell of our separation from God. My God, my God, why have you forsaken me? The spiritual pain had to be infinitely worse than the physical pain. That's what it cost him. He ran the race in spite of that cost, and he is the principal witness to us. Hang in there. Hang in there. Keep on keeping on. If I could sum all of that up, I would put it to you this way. You and I may have some great answers to prayer. We may experience some marvelous miracles from time to time because of the gracious provision of God. There may be some terrible setbacks as well, like those back in chapter 11 from verse 35 on. Some were tortured. Others suffered mocking and scourging, chains, imprisonment. They were stoned, they were sawn in two, they were killed with the sword. They went about in skins of sheep and goats, destitute, afflicted, and so on. There may be the great successes for some of us, some of the time. And there may be the terrible valleys for some of us, some of the time. In any event, nothing in this life is going to adequately fulfill the promises that God has made. They are yet to come. There is a better country. There is a heavenly kingdom. Keep it in mind as you run the race. The goal is before us. It's not a matter of God's in his heaven, all's right with the world. That is not the case. God is in his heaven and the world is all messed up. But my citizenship is with God. And so I run the race, whether it's with success or with terrible disappointment. The cost in following Christ, I think, for most of us, is relatively minor. Some of our brothers and sisters around the world, even right now, let alone down through history, have paid excruciating cost. But there may be a cost for us. There may be opposition from society, from friends, even from members of your own family. Jesus said, "Don't think I came to bring peace. I came to bring a sword. Set members of a family against each other. You follow me, and some of your family may rise up in terrible hostility." There may be hardship associated with obedience. I'm calling you to this. I chose it for you. It's tough to say yes. I didn't ask you. I simply ask you to follow. It may involve denial of self. It does. It certainly does. Denial of self and pleasures that we might otherwise have indulged in. There may be, at least apparently, unanswered prayers. All of this, the writer calls discipline. Discipline. He quotes, "My son, do not regard lightly the discipline of the Lord, nor lose courage when you are punished by him. For the Lord disciplines him whom he loves, and chastises every son, every daughter, whom he receives. It is for discipline that you have to endure. God is treating you as his children. What child is there whom his father does not discipline? If you're left without discipline, in which all have participated, then you are illegitimate children and not his sons and daughters. We've had an earthly father to discipline us. We respected him. Shall we not much more be subject to the Father of spirits?" Now notice, discipline is more than punishment. He says he will chastise if you need it. But discipline is more than punishment. It comes from the same root word as what? Discipleship. And sometimes he will allow us to go through some tough things, some costly, some painful things. And it's a matter of discipleship. He is forming us. He is shaping us after the image of his own Son. Could I put it to you this way? Answered prayer builds our faith. But it's when the prayer seems to be unanswered that our faith really needs to grow, isn't it? It seems right to me. It seems logical to me. I ought to go this way. I had a man in my office 2 hours ago who was just confronted with an overwhelming frustration. He thought that God was leading him to go this particular way, and it made sense, and he'd been arranging his life around it and planning for it and working on it and giving himself to it literally for a number of years, and he hit the brick wall. Frustration. And we began to reflect on St. Paul's experience. He wanted to go and evangelize the whole Mediterranean world. The Jews are continually harassing him. They're getting him arrested over and over and over again. And so he says, "I appeal to Caesar. Obviously, I want to be vindicated. But more than that, if I'm vindicated, it's going to vindicate the preaching of the gospel generally. I want to go before Caesar and have it declared once and for all that my preaching is legitimate." You know what happened? He got clapped into jail. Spent the rest of his life there, about 3 years, and was probably finally beheaded. And during that period, the whole Praetorian Guard gets evangelized. Caesar's own household gets evangelized. Most of the New Testament gets written. And instead of Paul being the one who personally took the gospel to the ends of the Roman Empire, some of those soldiers that he had been chained to ended up taking it for him at the expense of the Caesar who imprisoned him. And so you read Philippians, and you don't feel frustration and anger and bitterness. Paul says, I want you to know that what has happened to me has actually served to advance the gospel. See, I had my plan, and it hit the brick wall. But God had his plan, and it was better. You get it? I mean, that may have been a total mistake for Paul to appeal to Caesar. May have been the dumbest thing that he ever did. And yet God wove that mistake into his perfect plan. So, yes, there are wonderful successes, and sometimes there are terrible frustrations, and sometimes there is miscarriage of justice, and sometimes we make mistakes, however well-intentioned, and you know what? Right now is the beginning of the rest of your life. And God holds this moment in his hands, and he can turn it into something more wonderful than your best plan. Hang on. Keep on keeping on. Verse 12, therefore, as we just sang a moment ago, therefore, lift. How about that? Lift and it falls down. Therefore, lift your drooping podium. All right, we'll do it without. Therefore, lift your drooping hands and strengthen your weak knees. You know the reference to Moses. You know this story. Did we refer to this earlier? This comes from Exodus chapter 17, where the Israelites are in the middle of the Exodus experience, and they come to a place called Rephidim, and the Amalekites come against them, and it says that Moses went up on the side of the hill and watched the battle down in the valley. And it says he had the rod of God with him. That same rod that he used to strike the Red Sea and the children of Israel went across dry shod, and that same rod that he used to strike the flinty rock in the middle of the desert and water came out. It was the rod of God. It was the symbol of power. It was the symbol of his office, and God was with him. And it says that whenever Moses lifted up the rod of God, the Israelites prevailed. But when he got tired, couldn't hold it up any longer, his arms began to droop, he's exhausted, when he dropped it, in essence, the Amalekites prevailed. And so Aaron and Hur come alongside him, and they lift his hands. They hold up the rod of God. They strengthen his weak knees. And the writer says, do this. Do this yourself and do it for each other. Lift your drooping hands. You see, success is not a matter of whether or not we have it in us, but whether or not the rod of God is in the right place. Okay? And make straight paths for your feet so that what is lame may not be put out of joint, but rather be healed. When the answer doesn't come immediately, when it doesn't seem to be turning out the way that you had anticipated, he says, see that bitterness doesn't spring up and cause trouble and lead to a failure of faith so that you end up settling for a mess of pottage like Esau did when you could have inherited a kingdom. You know the story of Jacob and Esau. And Esau is the firstborn, and he should have had the birthright. He should have had all the inheritance that was his father's. But he gets hungry. And he settles for a bowl of soup that his brother has prepared for him. Here, I'll give you the soup, you give me your birthright. Total loss of perspective. I have this need right now, it's urgent, my stomach is growling, I've been out there in the field hunting, and I am famished, and he's offering me a bowl of soup, and for one bowl of soup, I give away my birthright. Don't do that. Don't do that. Don't make a mistake that will impact eternity, that will impact the better country. Don't give up the better country for the sake of some compromise here and now. There's a double reference in that exhortation. If you want to look very quickly at Deuteronomy 29, there's the reference to the bitter root springing up, verse 16 and following. You know how we dwelt in the land of Egypt and how we came through the midst of the nations through which you passed, and you have seen their detestable things, their idols of wood and stone, of silver and gold, which were among them. Beware, lest there be among you a man or a woman or family or tribe whose heart turns away this day from the Lord our God to go and serve the gods of those nations, lest there be among you a root bearing poisonous and bitter fruit, one who, when he hears the words of this sworn covenant, blesses himself in his heart, saying, I shall be safe, though I walk in the stubbornness of my heart. Don't let that happen. This would lead to the sweeping away of moist and dry alike. The Lord would not pardon him, but rather the anger of the Lord and his jealousy would smoke against that man, and the curses written in this book would settle upon him, and the Lord would blot out his name from under heaven. That's strong language, isn't it? Don't say to yourself, well, God is loving and merciful, and anything I do is just okay, peachy keen with him. If you're offending against what he has said, don't say, it shall be well with me. That, in fact, is a root springing up in your life which will bear poisonous and ultimately destructive fruits. Don't say, I want it. I must have it. I am this way and I can't change myself. I'm stuck with it. And therefore, I'm going to ignore what God has said. If he said it, I want to do it with his help. And it may be very costly, but consider the alternative. Keep on keeping on, and keep your eye upon the goal. There is a better country. There is a heavenly city. Mark Twain said, faith is believing what you know ain't so. Book of Hebrews says, faith is believing what you know is so, even when all the evidence points to the contrary. There's a wonderful story about a dad who was out swimming with his two children, and suddenly they found themselves being swept out to sea, one of those currents that just carried them away. And the father realized that he couldn't take both kids back with him at the same time. And so he said to his son, who was a little bit older and a little bit stronger, he said, just swim on your back. Just swim on your back. You're going to be okay, and I will come back. And he took the daughter, and he headed for shore. And 4 hours later, the lifeguard and the father came in a boat. And the little boy was there just swimming along on his back, absolutely unconcerned. And the lifeguard hauled him into the boat, and he said, weren't you afraid? And he said, no. My daddy said he'd come back. Hang on. Keep on keeping on. Faith is believing what you know is so, even if all the evidence points to the contrary. A year ago now, we were in the midst of trying to sell our property up in Virginia. We had already moved. We were here. And we had thought that that property would sell. We had an excellent realtor. We had two realtors, two of the best on the East Coast, and they had told us that thing's going to sell in a month. And it went on, and it went on, and it went on. And we got ourselves into the most complicated real estate hassle that I had ever heard of. We were trying to do a tax-free exchange on one piece of property, and we didn't know what we were doing, and our realtor had not dealt with that before, and we got legal advice how to do it, and we misunderstood the legal advice, and we filed the papers incorrectly, and we attached one thing to one contract which should have been attached to the other contract, and we suddenly realized it at about 9 o'clock at night, and they said, okay, it's going to be all right because we'll get to the real estate office first thing in the morning before they go to file. They're due to go to file at 10 a.m. We'll be there at 9. And the guy came in at 8:30 and filed it. And I am panicking. I mean, there are going to be thousands upon thousands of dollars of consequences if we don't do this thing right. And all the evidence is pointing in the wrong direction. And that's only one piece of an incredibly complicated story. And we're begging God, you've got to sell that property. Every day that goes by, we're paying interest and we're losing money and we've got a commitment here and we bought this house and this one isn't selling. Where are you, God? And it went on for month after month after month. And finally, the middle of last summer, I was listening to a tape by Malcolm Smith as I was driving over to the East Coast, and he was talking about prayer. And I'm not even sure what the connection was. It was sort of, I was listening to Malcolm with one ear, and I was praying, and I was trying to listen to God with the other ear at the same time. And I had the overwhelming sense that God was speaking to me. And he was saying to me, you sell the house. Take it out of the hands of the realtor. How can I sell? I'm in Florida. The house is in Virginia. We got the two best realtors on the East Coast trying to sell that blessed house. I sold it that night. There were further complications. When we got all done, what, 9 months, I guess, nearly about 8 months, after we realized that God had called us to come to Central Florida, and we worked out our finances, and we got all done, the thing had not worked out anything like we had planned. Not at all. None of it had gone right. And we came out within $1,000 of where we thought we needed to be. No, I wasn't worried. My daddy said he'd come back. Job said, though he slay me, yet will I trust him. That's faith. That's faith. Yes, there will be successes. Praise God. Yes, he does hear our prayers, and yes, he meets our needs, and yes, there are miracles. I believe in it. I pray for healing every single week, and I see people healed nearly every week. But sometimes there are unanswered prayers, or seemingly so, or they're not answered now, and we think we need it now, and it doesn't happen now, and it doesn't happen the way we had envisioned it. And maybe it doesn't happen at all because God had a different plan, and his plan was better than my plan. And in the midst of that, keep on keeping on. And if obedience is costly, it's costly. We were at a service, and there was a word, there was literally a word of prophecy one night, a word that said, someone here is compromising in a sexual way in your job. Your employer is asking you to do things that you know you mustn't do. You're a Christian and you mustn't do those things. And because you're afraid of losing your job, you've been agreeing to what your employer has demanded and you must stop. That was a word given in the midst of the meeting. And the next week, a woman came up to me after the service and she said, that was for me. And I went in and I saw my boss. And I told him I had to stop doing what I had been doing, and he fired me. And when his boss found out about it, he fired him, and I got his job. Sometimes it works out that way, and sometimes it doesn't. Keep on keeping on. Verse 18. For you have not come to what may be touched. A blazing fire and darkness and gloom and a tempest and the sound of a trumpet and a voice whose words made the hearers entreat that no further messages be spoken to them. For they could not endure the order that was given. If even a beast touches the mountain, it shall be stoned. Indeed, so terrifying was the sight that Moses said, I tremble with fear. You have not come to that. Think of what it would be like to have been there. On Mount Sinai, when God is speaking from thunder and lightning, and there is smoke upon the mountain, and there is a blazing fire. It says when Moses came down, the reflected glory on his face was so intense people couldn't stand to look at it. We're dealing with a holy God who has expectations and requirements and says, do it this way, not that way. Would you have liked to be there? The people said, we don't want any part of this. You go up and talk to him, Moses. Would you like to have been there? The writer says, you have not come to that. You've come to something infinitely more real. You have come to Mount Zion and to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, and to innumerable angels in festal gathering, and to the assembly of the firstborn who are enrolled in heaven, and to a judge who is God of all, and to the spirits of just men made perfect, and to Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant, and to the sprinkled blood that speaks more graciously than the blood of Abel. You've come to something more awesome, more overwhelming, more frightening in one sense, more real than that which could be touched physically. Do you see it that way? Are you able to see with the inner eye of the Spirit? That's what we've come to. We're dealing with something more real than Mount Sinai. So he says, see that you don't refuse him. Isn't it interesting? Verse 18, we have not come to what may be touched, a blazing fire. But verse 29, our God is a consuming fire. You don't see it with your eye, but the reality is greater than the fire on Mount Sinai. See that you don't refuse him. See that you don't refuse him. That's the message of the book of Hebrews. Final exhortations. Chapter 13, let brotherly love continue. Do not neglect to show hospitality to strangers, for thereby some have entertained angels unawares. Remember those who are in prison as though in prison with them, and those who are ill-treated, since you also are in the body. Let marriage be held in honor among all, and let the marriage bed be undefiled, for God will judge the immoral and adulterous. Keep your life free from love of money, and be content with what you have, for the Lord has said, I will never fail you nor forsake you. Hence we can confidently say, the Lord is my helper, I will not be afraid. What can man do to me? Exhortations to brotherly love, hospitality to strangers, compassion toward prisoners, faithfulness in marriage, freedom from materialism. And I have to ask, why in the world is the writer tacking on these homely little verities onto so grand a theme as that of running the great race of faith in the company of the mightiest heroes of history? And the answer is because it is precisely in those little everyday mundane details of our life that the great race is to be run. And that is the point of this book. Do you get it? It is precisely in your decisions as to how you're going to treat your spouse today, or what you're going to declare on your income taxes, or the impressions your kid forms of how you respond to what's going on television, or how you treat the homeless person that you bump into on the way out of this room, or what you do when somebody in your office irritates you. It is precisely in those little everyday mundane details that the race is to be run. You do realize that the decisions you make today may have eternal consequences. You realize that. Let me read you a marvelous passage. C.S. Lewis tells a story of a man, a college professor by the name of Elwin Ransom, literally being spirited by God to the planet Venus, where he has the opportunity to prevent a terrible repetition of what happened in the Garden of Eden. There is another man and another woman there, and there is another tempter there who is hammering away trying to get the woman to compromise, and Elwin has been sent there to try to intervene. And suddenly it dawns on him how preposterous that is, that he, this middle-aged college professor, can stop Satan. And he says, relentlessly, unmistakably, the darkness pressed down upon him the knowledge that the fate of a world really depended on how they behaved in the next few hours. The thing was irreducibly, nakedly real. They could, if they chose, decline to save the innocence of this new race. And if they declined, its innocence would not be saved. It rested with no other creature in all time or all space. This he saw clearly, though as yet he had no inkling of what he could do. The voluble self protested wildly, swiftly, like the propeller of a ship racing when it is out of the water. The imprudence, the unfairness, the absurdity of it. Did God want to lose worlds? What was the sense of so arranging things that anything really important should finally and absolutely depend on such a man of straw as himself? And at that moment, far away on earth, as he now could not help remembering, men were at war, and white-faced subalterns and freckled corporals, who had but lately begun to shave, stood in horrible gaps or crawled forward in deadly darkness, awaking, like him, to the preposterous truth that all really depended on their actions. And far away in time, Horatius stood on the bridge, and Constantine settled in his mind whether he would or would not embrace the new religion. And Eve herself stood looking upon the forbidden fruit, and the heaven of heavens waited for her decision. He writhed and ground his teeth, but could not help seeing this and not otherwise the world was made. Either something or nothing must depend on individual choices. And if something, who could set bounds to it? A stone may determine the course of a river. He was that stone at this horrible moment, which had become the center of the whole universe, the angels of all worlds, the sinless organisms of everlasting light, were silent in deep heaven to see what Elwin Ransom of Cambridge would do. And you have no way of knowing, nor do I, the significance of the decisions you make this afternoon. It's in the details that the race is run. There and there alone, we will either look unto Jesus, the founder and finisher of our faith, and we will throw off whatever weights and sin clings to us and run the race this afternoon, or we'll give it away for a mess of pottage. He says, verse 8, Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. Verse 18, he says, pray for us. For we are sure that we have a clear conscience, desiring to act honorably in all things. We need the exact same encouragement and help that you do. We want to act honorably in all things, in the details, this afternoon. Now the God, may the God of peace, who brought again from the dead our Lord Jesus, the great shepherd of the sheep, by the blood of the eternal covenant, equip you with everything good, that you may do his will, working in you that which is pleasing in his sight, through Jesus Christ, to whom be glory forever and ever.